tonight on Arena. My Mum Jane, a documentary on Jane Mansfield as seen through the eyes of her daughter, and Roger Doyle and Joe Mangan on their mixed reality opera for the Kilkenny Arts Festival. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena, and you can watch us on rte.ie/arena. Jane Mansfield was a 1950s Hollywood actress and singer known for her bombshell persona, platinum blonde hair and roles in films like The Girl Can't Help It. But behind the glamour, she struggled with depression and typecasting until her tragic death in a car crash at the age of just 34. Mansfield was survived by five young children, including a three-year-old daughter, Mariska, from her second marriage to the Hungarian-American actor and bodybuilder Mickey Hargitay. Mariska, herself an actor and producer, is best known for her role as Captain Olivia Benson on the police drama Law and Order Special Victims Unit. Mariska has just directed a documentary which launches tomorrow on Sky and Now TV. My Mum Jane is her search for the real Jane Mansfield. She uses archival footage, photos and sibling interviews to build the picture of her mother behind the dumb blonde image. Ruth Barton has been watching it for us, and she's with me in studio this evening. There are so many revelations in this documentary.
It is absolutely...
It's a minefield of spoiler alerts.
It's surely a spoiler alert, and we'll keep the last revelation, which is the most astonishing. We'll keep let people watch it for themselves.
Absolutely.
You're just thinking, I can't know anymore. And then suddenly
and then,
you get this like, whoa. Like, oh,
and that's the last third of the documentary.
Yeah, and actually, and as soon as you get it, you get, of course, that's
It makes sense of much that has gone before.
Yep.
However, let us talk about, to start, put Jane Mansfield in context in the 1950s. And one of the things that comes across in the documentary, you know, she wanted to be a serious actor, no question about that. But she also liked publicity. And then somebody told her to dye her hair blonde. And she kind of becomes...
We're talking about this is
a Marilyn Monroe takeoff,
doesn't
she?
Exactly what I was going to say. This is the era of Marilyn Monroe, who also struggled with the dumb blonde, image. And so here you have this woman. I mean, she was pretty... Like, she was very, very young. So first of all, she marries this guy, Mansfield, Paul Mansfield, who was this sort of church-going Texan and good old boy.
Yeah, she was 16 when she had her first child.
She had her first child. And at that age, she suddenly decides, I'm going to make it in Hollywood. So she up sticks and goes to Hollywood. So Mansfield's not too happy. This does not accord with his church-going principles. So she dumps him and she heads off to various kind of motel rooms with her eldest daughter, Jane Marie, who's Mansfield and her daughter. And she basically will do anything to make it in Hollywood. So she's selling popcorn. She's doing, you know, iffy videos or photography. She's doing whatever she can. And she kind of always knows she's on the cusp of it. It's not quite happening. But then she meets Paramount talent scout Milton Lewis. And Milton Lewis says, oh, you've got to be Marilyn, honey. Dye your hair blonde and make the best of your assets. And so she dyes her hair blonde, she lowers her cleavage, and bingo.
But even that phrase, and that is the phrase that
that's
used.
That's the phrase they use.
Make the best of your assets.
Yeah.
I mean, it tells us really, to a large extent, how actresses were seen by so many producers and casting people at the time.
They were, and I mean, also they were money. So, who could make you the most money? Somebody with these looks. And who does, and you know, she makes herself a career. She starts off with Will Success, Spoiler Rock Hudson, which was a big hit, and she's the ditzy blonde in that.
And was that on Broadway as well as
a
film?
She starts in theatre and then it transfers to film. That's the really big breakthrough.
Yeah.
And as I said, there's all these dumb blonde roles. And all the time, she's having these kids, right? Mm. So first of all, okay, so she leaves Mansfield and then she meets up with this really decent guy, Mickey Hargitay. And Hargitay is a Hungarian...
I mean, even as you say his name, I almost, you know, he comes across so well in this documentary.
He is such a decent guy. Yeah. And he's, you know, he's a Hungarian dancer, and then he comes to America. He breaks through as a bodybuilder. He becomes Mr. Universe. And you can, again, you could hardly make it up, but they fall in love with each other and then they have... Well, three more children. So Mickey Jr., Zoltan, and then our narrator and director, Mariska. And they're really happy together, but there's something, you know, she can't keep it going. She can't keep, like, she's destined to kind of, just as it's going right, to do something that sends everything spiraling.
And the real joy for me, at any rate, one of the many joys in this documentary is the narrator, who is Mariska Hargitay.
Yeah, oh, she's fantastic. I mean, of course, she's a really successful actress.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
I mean, she's actually sort of, you know, nerdy footnote. Her character in Law and Order is the longest running character on Prime TV.
Wow.
Yeah. So she is so experienced, and that experience shows when she's in front of the camera because she's very cool.
But I have to say, as are the non-acting siblings.
Oh yeah.
There's a wonderful rapport. She kind of puts
really
them at ease.
Does.
You can see the emotional bond between
Zoltan,
all of them.
Zoltan in particular, he just looks at the camera and he cracks up.
He starts crying.
You know? And so I need a bit of space. So she gives him a bit of space. And then, you know, she cuts to Mickey Jr., who's a bit more composed. And then she also roots out another half-brother because Jane Mansfield, you know, the career didn't really last that long. And so by the time, you know, she's getting into her early 30s, she's realised it's kind of up for her.
Yeah, let's listen to Mariska Hargitay. This is how she kind of setting up what she wanted to find out, because she had a difficult relationship with
her. She did.
Her mother died when she was just three.
Just three. Yeah. And she says, when you look at the photographs, my mother's never holding me like she held my older siblings.
Yeah, and there's the big hint for what's coming up later on.
I was 3 years old when my mom died. And I don't really have any memories of her. I can remember one time eating a bowl of cereal. And I remember her touching my hair. But I don't know if that's a real memory or something that I made up because I wished it happened. After she passed away, a moment that's always stayed with me is when I found my baby book. All of my siblings had one, but when I looked through mine, it was practically empty. So, on top of having no memories, I think it just gave me a sense of more loss. It was like this little hole in my heart.
There we go. That's Mariska Hargitay reflecting on her childhood and her memories of her mother. And she's just very touching the way she speaks about her there. A bit of clever music underneath.
Yeah, it has to be said.
There's a little bit of emotion.
It's a very well-made documentary, you have to say.
Very well.
This is her first documentary that she's directed, and you'd think she'd been doing it all her life.
Well, she has been doing Law and Order
for a long time. Yeah,
and that
fair
knows
enough,
how to,
yeah.
She knows how to tell a
she's
story.
She's got timing. She's got really good timing.
And she knows in the writing of this, and it's one of the reasons it's difficult in some ways to talk about, she just revealed these revelation after revelation, and just at the point when you're thinking, okay, I've got it now, Then there comes another one.
She kind of hints at the big revelation, but you're not getting it until you see it. Yeah. And you go, yeah.
It would merit watching it twice to see where she's put the hints in earlier on. But, you know, I was... there's a couple of things. It was clear that Mariska Hargitay had a very conflicted relationship with her mother. She ignored the presence of this woman in her life. She didn't look into her career. There were loads of books written about her. Her father said, don't go near those books. They're full of rubbish and lies. Some of which was true, some of which was not true. They weren't all lies.
As we discover.
Yeah, there may have been a lot of rubbish in them, but they weren't all lies. Nope. But she wanted to discover the serious actor. And you know, as some of the footage that we get here, it's extraordinary.
There's a horror story chat show interview.
Oh, yeah.
With Merv, whatever his name is.
Yeah.
And she's you know, she can play the piano.
Yeah.
She's a very accomplished pianist.
Quite well, and the violin.
Accomplished violinist, and she speaks multiple languages.
Yeah.
And,
None of which you would have said if you'd seen her in any of those.
No, you'd never think, oh, she's living the dumb blonde role. Hmm. And she really wants to be taken so seriously. And so she tells him this, and she starts to play the violin, and she tunes it a bit, and he's kind of, you know, he's beginning to sort of go, ha, ha. And then she plays a tiny tune on the violin, and Merv, whatever his name is, leans around and says, kiss me.
Yeah.
That's gross.
I know, it's terrible.
It's so disgusting.
Oh, it's harassment. It's
it really, really is. And so she can never escape that image.
Except, I have to say, and this one surprised me, the chatter, what was it called at the time? Groucho Marx.
Groucho Marx.
Tell Groucho or talk to Groucho.
Yeah,
I can't remember what.
And Groucho got it.
And Groucho, where do you hear his interview with her?
Yeah,
when
fantastic.
You compare it to the absolute awfulness of the other interview. Listen to Groucho Marx, Mr. Funny Man, talking to the so-called blonde bombshell. Listen to how he treats her.
I knew this before when I did that picture with you.
Well, successful rock hunter.
Yeah, that was a pretty funny picture.
You're the cutest leading man I ever had
yet. Yes, and the oldest, too. You know, you're actually, and I've told this to other people, you're not the dumb blonde that you pretend to be. And I think the people ought to know that you're really a bright, sentimental, and understanding person. And this is a whole facade of yours that isn't based on what you actually are.
Oh, that's sweet of you.
Well,
thank you so much.
I think you're aware of that, Jane. This is a kind of an act you do, isn't it?
Oh, it's,
most people don't know that, though.
I think that it's like this. The public pays money, the box office, to see me a certain way, and...
And they get their money's worth, too.
So I think it's just all part of the role I'm playing as an actress. Uh-huh.
That's Jane Mansfield there.
So insightful.
Yeah, really. My Mum Jane is the documentary that we're speaking about with Ruth Barton this evening. Mariska Hargitay, the daughter of Jane Mansfield, brings us through her mother's life and career and reveals so much to us.
So many family secrets.
Some people might know some of it because some of it has been in books before.
Yeah, if you're a diehard fan.
Yeah,
and actually one of the characters is a diehard fan.
Yeah.
It's he who really lets the cat out of the bag.
Yeah.
If you're a diehard fan, you'll know the big secret. But I mean, I didn't. I thought... Jane Mansfield, and I mean, I kind of thought, I could picture her, but I hadn't really thought. I mean, I didn't know she was so intelligent, spoke all these languages, was musically gifted.
Were you amazed? I mean, I was amazed because one particular, and I'm really glad we have this clip from Wayward Bus in 1957. This is now. Listen to the voice that we heard there with Groucho. And Groucho, yes, of course, he still has the fun and all the rest, but he points out this is all an act, isn't it? He's given her. And she takes it as a compliment.
Yes, she does because she.
But
says,
she keeps up that kind
and
of.
And there's this thing about the breathy voice as well. It's a kind of Marilyn voice.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure if you're playing that clip, but
no, I was saying in the Groucho thing, she still has that kind of performance voice, which all the children refer to.
That's right, and that she's and she says Mariska says to her older siblings who remember their mom better, did she come home and talk like that? And they said no. No, she didn't. No. That was her stage voice.
No makeup at home. No,
And, I mean, some eccentricities at home. She had an ocelot in the back garden. Well, I mean, okay, it's Hollywood.
Yeah. And she had a few bob, clearly. She had the ocelot and the zoo out the back.
Yeah, but then everything got sold because she died and she hadn't made... Well, I mean, she died very young. She wasn't expected to die. She hadn't made a will. And so the children were also left with nothing. They were left with none of the kind of material possessions of their childhood, apart from everything that was boxed up and put away in a container.
Yeah, and I don't think I'm giving anything away to say, like, at that stage she had split from Mickey Hargitay. He takes the children on board with his new wife, who treats them as
she
her...
She is one of the saints of this
decent,
story.
The most decent couple you could meet.
Yeah, she is just such a good... And she says, I know that actually he was always in love with her until the moment of her death. And she talks really articulately about Mickey, about the kids, and these fantastic photographs of the kids looking really, really happy around a dinner table with their father and his new wife, who was... There's a few people who come out of this so well.
And
you
she
think
does.
These awful Hollywood stories, but she is just such a decent woman.
I want to listen to a clip because I think if this is the one that I think is, it's Wayward Bus from 1957, Jane Mansfield and Joan Collins. And this is a different voice from maybe the I hate even the term dumb blonde, but nevertheless, we have to use it in terms of what, because it was a kind
persona.
Of a product.
Yeah,
that was the product that was being sold here.
Mm-hmm.
Here she is, though, in Wayward Bus from 1957.
None of my business, but mind if I tell you what I did to a guy I was in love with once? Broke a chair over his head after I caught him kissing some dame at a party. He never tried that again. Don't know, never saw him after that. But he's married, happily married. And I make a living. Believe me, breaking a chair over a guy's head can sure work miracles. Kind of miracles, the loss of your whole life.
Yeah. That's Jane Mansfield
real
there.
It's a woman's picture too.
Yeah,
it's a real woman's
Where Would Bus 1957. Yeah. Joan Collins was the other person in the scene with her. Ruth Barton speaking to us about My Mum Jane, Mariska Hargitay, who you know from Law and Order, her documentary about her mother.
Yeah, just uncovering all these truths and dust.
And it keeps on, and we can't give away the big final one, but in the midst of all of this, there are many people who could have taken the Mansfield family, the Hargitay family, to the cleaners and cleaned them out of every single penny they had. This is, contrary to the usual Hollywood story, this has the biggest cast of decent people that I've ever come across.
I mean, first of all, there's the siblings. Now, I would have said maybe, so husband number three was Matt Simber. And there's a separate interview with Tony, his son, and she's saying to Tony, and he was abusive. Matt Simber was abusive. We you know, because she's describing going into the house, her mother comes out.
She was in the car with him when she died, wasn't she?
Yep, she was, and her other lover.
Yeah.
But she describes when they were married, when she was married to Simber, Jane Mansfield coming out of the bathroom wearing dark glasses. She takes off the dark glasses. Both eyes are black and blue, and so she sits down. I mean, this is the toughest interview, I think. You know, she's toughest with Tony Simber, and she says, "What did you know?" And he says, "Oh, well, you know, I mean, maybe I knew stuff, but that's all in the past, and it really doesn't matter." And he's actually quite good looking. And he's got a bit of a career in Hollywood. And so he doesn't want to sully that by being, you know, tarred with the father's brush, even though he's probably made the most of what he had because of his background. So there is this. So she does go into quite dark places.
And she also, at one stage, interviews a publicity agent, her mother's publicity agent, who knew an awful lot. And he said,
and writes a tell-all book.
Yeah.
And she says, how could you do that?
Was it your story to tell?
Yeah.
Great question.
He's very elderly, in his 90s, and he's quite sort of gung-ho. He likes being interviewed until she asks him the hard questions. Then he's backing back. Yeah, okay, I'm in, enough of this.
And my favourite moment of all, when they're in the lock-up where all her mother's archive stuff is, you know, old pictures, family pictures, and a Golden Globe.
Yeah.
And the, one of the siblings turns around to Mariska Hargitay and says, "Put that on beside yours on the show," and you say, "Oh my God, they're just so nice,
decent people."
People don't often, you know, don't often make good television. They're here.
They're really decent. Obviously, very proud of Mariska, and you know they're enjoying her success, and perhaps they're seeing a bit of a continuation of maybe what their mother could have been, because it's a very different character that she plays. You know, in Law and Order, she's certainly not the dumb blonde.
No.
Right. So it's almost like she's the kind of corrective in their lives to where their mother went wrong.
Yeah.
And yet they loved their mother. Yeah. You know, the ones who could remember her. They adored her. So there's so many contradictions as well in this
story. It's a fascinating documentary.
Fascinating. I just so recommend people to watch it.
Yeah. And have the Kleenex. nearby.
Get ready for the ending.
the end. Not even going to go there.
But
have the Kleenex. That is the advice. My Mom Jane is what we've been talking about with Ruth Barton. It's a new documentary from Mariska Hargitay of Law and Order fame. It's about her late mother, the actress Jane Mansfield. It can be seen on Sky and Now TV from tomorrow. Martin Dyer's second poetry collection, The Meek, links environmental awareness with human experience as the collection moves from wildlife and landscapes to questions of empathy and moral understanding. Originally from Swinford in County Mayo, Martin Dyer is the author of the Pickett Prize shortlisted Maiden Names, the editor of Vital Signs, Poems of Illness and Healing. His work spans poetry, drama, music, including a national tour of a poetry song cycle, Buonia Nguiha, created by the composer Ryan Malloy. A winner of the Patrick Kavanagh Poetry Award, Martin teaches medical humanities at Trinity College Dublin, and delighted that he's with me in the studio this evening. In fact, we've spoken about that side of your life before, Martin, and in particular about the anthology that you were part of, Poems of Illness and Healing. And that medical and science side is present here in The Meek as well. I suppose you can't ignore it. It's a big part of who you are.
Yeah, definitely. I've been marked in some way, Sean, by the privilege of teaching medical students over the years. In some cases, when I'm writing, I'm wondering where is it and where is the exploration of science, but I find that talking to medical students who are not qualified doctors at the end of the day, but feel that they're very much on their way and have a particular focus on the experience of the experiences of patients, talking to them about care, about the principles of medical ethics, but talking to them about poetry, talking to them about film is enormously stimulating, and it gives you a very strong sense of what's at stake in healthcare environments.
Yeah, and you're talking about medical students there and then becoming doctors. Do you speak to many who become vets? Because it struck me, particularly in this collection, that the presence of the animal world, and I mean often the farm animal or the beloved horse or the beloved cow or the beloved, you know, animals and how they are treated within our current society, that is very much to the fore here.
It is. It's an ecologically inclined book. Do I talk to medical students about veterinary things? It certainly comes up. I mean, the vision of health and healthcare has embraced our environmental problems, and some of the solutions are bound up with thinking ecologically. I think in terms of my own roots, how I got into medical education, or how I initially convinced the School of Medicine that I might be a good candidate, even though I was coming strictly speaking from the arts and the humanities. Going into my own background, I think my parents' enthusiasm for animals, my mother was a nurse, my father was involved in sales with pharmaceutical companies, but they saw themselves as animal lovers first and foremost. Yeah. So I came out of a house where there was a lot of technical talk and ad lib animal health. And I definitely carried that forward. I carried forward their vocabularies on healthcare.
You mentioned your father being a rep for a veterinary pharmaceuticals, I presume.
Medical
pharmaceuticals. Yeah. No, I was wondering who came across the opening poem in the book, which we can't read because it's just a bit too long, but it's a beautiful poem called Burke's Goddess, and it's about this man who's he's on the phone to the vet, and he knows that this mare she's at the end of her days, and the beautiful care, the palliative care, and the way he treats this animal, it's very touching.
Yeah, thank you, Sean. I found myself being interested in the aspects of ourselves that are authentically and passionately connected to animals. And I think you have to think about, I found myself thinking about individuals and characters who in some ways had the kind of eccentric leaning towards animals, animal lovers, to use that phrase again. In that poem, certainly I was asking myself, how far can we go, or how much of that sense of that wordless relationship between the owner and the horse, how far can we get it up onto the surface of the poem? That's one of the ways that I understand poetry as a digging down into instincts and trying to bring them up and turn them into spectacles.
It's totally out of left field. Did you see Andrea Arnold's documentary Cow? By any chance?
Not yet.
No, go and watch because it literally just follows the life of a cow from birth through until the inevitable spot for a cow to go, whether that's at the end of its dairy life or at the point at which it's going to become beef. Go watch that. I think you'll be very, very interested in it. However, The Meek is the title of the collection, and you're going to read the title poem for us here, which touches on some of the things that we get in the opening poem, Burke's Goddess. It's not dissimilar in many ways.
Yeah, that's true. I found myself recently referring to it as a vegetarian fantasy. It's a poem about animal welfare and animal rights, and it's a poem that gives some thought to those individuals who feel that particularly strong connection, and I suppose indeed more broadly that sense of a promise sort of ecological exploration in terms of our difficulties. But I'll read The Meek. She aimed the arrow of herself at welfare. It was as if the animals had known how, through some form of agricultural hoax, some trick of animal telling, to cause the truth of their deep suffering to coil tight around her and make of her their most disciplined human agent, a woman fit to put their world securely into words, wear their mantle and be their steel-willed, outspoken saint of claws and hooves and meadows. We, her followers, fear the price she paid. Slaughter is the future. And yet we trust in her cold acceptance of nature's cold view that all of life is love misunderstood.
Martin Dyer reading the title poem from his new collection, The Meek. It's a great idea that the animals, kind of George Orwell-like, group together and get a human to act on their behalf.
I think some people do feel conscripted in some way. I think that passion is real, that sense of connection is real, even if we can't always find the words to communicate it. And I think in our troubled age, despite the fact that it isn't always easy to maintain hope, I do think those things are coming to the surface with an amazing vividness.
The other, there are many aspects to the collection, obviously, but another important strand within it, or strain, if I can use that particular metaphor, is the musical strain within the entire collection. I mentioned Bua na Gcuaighe, which is published within this. Is it a five poem cycle?
Yes, it is.
And was it a song cycle then that you were involved with the composer Ryan Malloy?
That's right. It turned out as a piece for soprano, harp and flute, which was performed by Damselfly Trio. And a fascinating experience. Ryan Malloy is a great philosopher of his own craft, and so the conversations we had were absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, and when you wrote the poems, did you write the poems then consult with Ryan and off he went and composed, or did the poems change? Did you end up adjusting things to fit in with perhaps the musical ideas that Ryan was putting to you?
There was a little bit of that, and there was certainly a considerable anxiety around that about whether the poems that I was writing would be of interest to Ryan. We had started off with a great head of steam, and he had plenty of ideas. But we discovered a connection. We discovered a respect between us. So it did flow. And then when it came to doing a tour to Damselfly Trio coming on board, there was a whole a sort of anticipation of how they would interpret, let's say, the poems in particular, how the words would be enunciated, how the melodies would pan out, how the meanings of the poems might be put under pressure. And that was a great joy. It was a great joy. They brought the singer in particular brought an actorly approach to the singing and to the poems.
We'll move to one of the poems that deals directly, well, maybe sideways, it deals with music. John Reilly's Audition, Roscommon, 1966. Tell us a little bit about John Reilly and what drew you to him as a subject for this poem.
I think the poem was triggered and kind of initiated by a remark by Christy Moore. John Reilly's a fascinating figure. He was born in Carrick on Shannon, lived in Belfast for some time. He was a traveller steeped in music, a gifted tinsmith. And he died quite young, died in his late 30s. But in the early 60s, he was living in a kind of a musical milieu in Boyle, friendly with the Grehan sisters. He was befriended by the song collector Tom Munley, and Christy Moore knew him as well. Christy Moore, many years later, remarked that there was something deeper than entertainment about John Reilly's style of singing, and his music is wonderful, and it was Tom Munley who realised that he was an extraordinary bearer of an oral tradition and versions of songs like the Raggle Taggle Gypsy, which Planxty picked up directly from John Reilly, and the Well Below the Valley. There's an unbroken line back through John Reilly's family and across the centuries. So that deeper than entertainment, it really struck me. There's been a significant amount of tributes to John Reilly over the years, and I think there's. The fascination around him is growing. He was an extraordinary talent as well as a bearer of tradition.
Well, let's hear in some ways your tribute to him in John Reilly's Audition, Roscommon, 1966, from the new collection, The Meek.
John Reilly's Audition, Roscommon, 1966. On entering that near-eclipsed pub in Boyle, the collector received a proud nod from Dodd, the owner of the place, who the night before had promised, "I know a traveller, a man so full of old songs it would frighten you." Dodd's eye cast a curatorial light now towards an isolated drinker by the fire. A dignified clown, ruined boots and teeth, generous eyes, unreckonable age. "When I say full," Dodd had said, "I mean full to the brim." He had overblown it, more than likely. Or had he? The required ghosts were in John's speaking voice, around a tree of verses that swiveled when he sang and caught all hearts.
And that's Martin Dyer reading John Reilly's audition, Roscommon, 1966, from his new collection, The Meek. The Meek is a slightly, I'm not going to say misleading, is a bit nasty, but it's a word that, you know, you might think, all right, this is going to be about lots of gentle souls and people who are lovely around animals and lovely tunes.
Yeah.
But there's more to The Meek than that.
There's a risk in it as a title, I'd admit that. And but it's a title that felt right. And that sonnet that I've just read felt, that The Meek felt like the title poem. And I thought that through, but it's a strong instinctual thing when something grabs you in that way. And I was reminded by a story the poet Bernard O'Donoghue once told, when he told a friend that his new collection was going to be called The Weakness. A friend whose opinion mattered a great deal to him said, ooh, very brave, very brave. Yeah. So, yes, there's an ambiguity around that. But I feel that the poems have interesting ways of playing with the implications of the word, including its biblical root, and opening up the idea of gentleness, of sensitivity, and music, I suppose, is one version of that meekness. I am interested in musical ability and musical performance, in the experience of music. That goes back to my dialogue with Ryan and the composer Conor Walsh. And it works. And now that the book is published, the title means, I think, something else. It refers directly to the book. That trepidation has passed, Sean.
A word can hold a lot more than just one meaning. You mentioned Conor Walsh there, and I want to finish with a poem that brings the music and the medical together in some ways, because this is in memory of Conor Walsh, your poem Pharmacy. Tell us a little bit about it.
It's a poem that that looks at an aspect of Conor Walsh's life and indeed his legacy. So he's a celebrated minimalist piano composer, somebody that I worked and performed with, someone who had a huge influence on myself in terms of the very idea of being a poet, trying to be an artist in Ireland. But he was also, in addition to being a very committed musician, somebody who was making sacrifices for their work, he was a passionate angler and a kind of a figure on the landscape in County Mayo. Indeed, he's probably unique in being the only musician who, as part of his legacy, has a perpetual cup for the catching of the first salmon of the year in his name, in his honour, in addition to having a musical award through Hard Working Class Heroes. So he really straddles these two worlds.
Yeah.
And Conor's music is reflective and it's rich and it's cinematic. But it is, and I guess I know this from having known Conor, it's rich in narrative and it is rich in environmental implications. So I see his music anytime I hear it, and it circulates constantly on TV and radio these days. It's a kind of an ecological event, and it's also a delightful reminder of his of what he achieved.
Well, let's hear Pharmacy then.
As it happens, Conor died of a heart attack, and so this poem considers the flower, the foxglove, and its connection to heart medicine. So I follow him into parts of Mayo that only he knew. Pharmacy, in memory of Conor Walsh. Foxglove, I'm led to believe you can see my heart's want of balance, even though, as a flower, your life is a God-given blindness. They say, too, that because of your poise, your personality, you are alive to her need of a petaled voice, one that will explain to her intimately her own percussive heat, her doubt. Famously, thus, you've led bad hearts to the trough of wholeness. If, foxglove, you are true, then do not wait till I have locked you in compounds to express your deep vocation. Radiate now, this very moment. Speak out and boost my hands as I cut you here in this steep, wild, vaporing, blue-roofed County Mayo drain. And listen carefully, and more than carefully, with me, as I listen to the bright declining bird my wet shirt shields.
Martin Dyer reading his poem Pharmacy from his new collection The Meek, which is published by Wake Forest University Press. Now, when one of our most acclaimed composers, who's been nicknamed for a long time the godfather of electronica, comes together with one of our most renowned artists specialising in immersive technology, we can be sure something special is about to happen. Roger Doyle and Joe Mangan are collaborating on a mixed reality opera, which will be performed for the first time at Kilkenny Arts Festival next month. We Who Live Under Heaven is the title of the show. And rather than me say what it is, I'm going to ask you guys to explain to me. You don't need the headphones unless you want to wear them. You can be wearing them if you want them. You don't have to wear them.
Delighted not to wear them.
If you don't want to. I suppose I'll start with, what's a mixed reality opera? Which
well,
is the obvious question, isn't it?
There you go. I suppose...
Joe Mangan, yeah. a producer and director.
Sometimes people would have, you know, an idea of what virtual reality is. It's those big unwieldy goggles that people put on their heads, and they get brought into worlds that might be games, or they might be trying to operate on pretend humans for training purposes. But we like to hack these devices and try and make art with them and try and make performance with them, but particularly live performance. That's what excites me. So we've done some work in virtual reality, the Performance Corporation has, and this time we're taking it a step further and working with Roger. So working with his music and creating what is a... It would be effectively like you're in the real world. You put a pair of these goggles on, so you still see the real world, but then you see everything else layered on top of it. So the everything else is where our designer, our 3D designer, Kira Del Grosso Bates, who runs the immersive agency, comes in. So I've been working a lot with her to try and create this fantastical world that our audiences in Kilkenny Arts Festival get into.
I would guess, Roger Doyle, that when Joe Mangan started talking to you, or when you started speaking to each other about a project like this, you know, 5 decades and electronic music was in its infancy in terms of Irish composition, certainly when you started out. When Joe was talking to you about the kind of the mix of technology and art here, must have been a very exciting prospect.
Yeah, it's collaboration really at its richest is how I feel. If you're a composer working alone, you're collaborating with yourself, basically. Which, of course, has its own thrills and obstacles. But when you're collaborating with people who are approaching your work from a totally different technical viewpoint and expertise, it's a very, very rich experience. I mean, of course, I have collaborated over the years many a time with
well, yourself and Alwyn Ferrier, one of the great collaborations
in terms of
theatre and music.
So that's the music meeting the theatre, and what a rich seam that proved to be. So this is now music and computers, technology and virtual reality, and it's a whole other world where we talk to each other in terms of, you know, can you get it to do that? You know? Yeah, sure, yeah.
Well, you know, but when I think oftentimes, I'll be careful how I phrase this, but oftentimes I think in the world of the arts, when we hear the words virtual reality or the words artificial intelligence, we go, no, stop that. That's going to rule all creativity. You know what's going to happen? The artificial intelligence is going to take over writing, composing. It's going to take over everything, and we'll have nothing left to do. Do we need to calm down a little bit, Joe?
I certainly think so. Look, I do a lot of kind of talks and presentations on that very topic. It's a rich seam, not unlike the seam we're sort of exploring with this work. To me, it's like pretending the internet didn't exist in the 90s, or going, I'm never getting a mobile phone. What would I ever want a mobile
Which
phone
we
for?
All said for 6 months.
Indeed. No, it's here, it's now. It is artificial intelligence in particular it has gone beyond training itself on the models of the artist's source material. It is now training itself on the training that it has already done. The genie has left the bottle.
Yeah. And we want artists to be, if it's going to train on the artist's work, well then pay the artist for using its work to train
yourself. Oh, look, I think you're going to have to get me back for another conversation about that.
That's a whole other
absolutely
3-week program.
Totally.
That we'll do at some other point. But I wonder to what extent, Roger, Was there a similar or some kind of parallel resistance to electronic music, you know, when you were in those early days? People said, oh, that's not, what's he doing there only twiddling a few buttons?
I even got it from fellow composers at the time and read many books which were against, you can't blame the clarinet that plays Bartok instead of Mozart or something was one of the arguments. But, I mean, it never really hampered. You know, the 70s were good time for me. I got on the radio a lot. I had records out. I had a record with CBS Records. So it wasn't really the dark ages.
Yeah.
It was easier than you might think. And I brought out my first LP 50 years ago, 2 weeks ago.
Wow.
50
Yeah, you were celebrating that, I think, in recent times, weren't you?
I was.
Yeah.
June the 18th, 1975.
Wow.
It was a record called Oizono.
Well, there you go. And what were you doing 50 years ago?
You don't need to answer that question. How dare you, Sean?
I kind of guessed that. I want to listen to some of the music from We Who Live Under Heaven. Maybe you know the piece of music that we have here, Roger.
Yeah,
so maybe
you
could explain what this is from and how it fits into the show overall.
Yeah. Okay. We have a live performer.
Morgan Crowley will be singing on
the
night.
He will be singing, yeah. And he will be responding to certain pieces of music. He will sing a contour melody over what's there.
Mm.
But he'll also, in this particular extract, he'll be responding to the sound of what we imagine to be another alien being. And he's having a conversation with this other alien.
Yeah, because in the midst of this, I hear, or when I was listening earlier on, I heard something that was like a voice, but not necessarily a human voice. So we're to think of this as some kind of other being that the live performer is having a conversation with. Let's have a listen to some of it.
Oh.
go. That's some of the music from Who Live Under Heaven, the mixed reality opera that we're speaking about this evening with composer Roger Doyle and producer and director of the Performance Corporation, Joe Mangan. I was saying, as we were listening to that, I was asking, first of all, what is that sound that we hear coming? Because there's the kind of the underlying sound, bed of sound, Roger, and then that little call that comes in, almost like somebody shouting, you know, is there anybody there? Is there anybody listening to me?
That is exactly what we think too. For that, those voice sounds were actually originally made by my wife Mary,
who's with us tonight outside, I believe,
sitting outside, and transformed, you know, fed through the pieces of fancy software and. And the chord underneath is actually the chord from an orchestral work of mine.
Oh, right.
It's frozen in time, you know. That chord, at that length, it's about the right length, but the piece of software, it could go on all day.
Yeah, it could last forever. for a long time. And Joe, and we were talking as we were listening there too. This idea, yes, there is a kind of a source. So Morgan Crowley, the tenor, countertenor actually, isn't he, will interact with that sound live.
Exactly. Yeah.
There will also be your visual team.
Yeah.
Their technology will respond to the sounds that they're hearing.
Exactly. So some of it, again, it's the magic of wonderful software and incredible creative technologists who are able to program visuals to respond to sound. So as we're in the space, these shapes will emerge around us. Another being will come to commune with the live being, and colours and scale and all of that will respond to the music. Yeah. So a lot of that work has already been done. The interesting thing I find about the mixed reality world is that we see the real world, and then the shapes and the elements that are designed beyond that can be up in the ceiling. They can be 100 feet below you in the
floor. And it's the software that will decide that in some way. Well, I don't know if decide is the right verb.
Yeah, no, it's very much determined by the designer, by Kira. Mm. So it's, you know, we're working together a lot back and forth in the headsets, and she's sending files and I'm downloading them and making sure I'm in a well-lit room to be able to see everything working properly. But it's a fascinating process. It's really backwards, because you normally go into rehearsals and you create the performance, and then you work with the composer, try and generate the music that works. It all happens sort of simultaneous.
But this is a response to the music.
Exactly. Yeah. So the music was pretty locked down very early on in the process. Mm. Then the visuals are in the process of being almost locked down. And of course, we've been rehearsing with Morgan as well. But it's kind of like what they do a lot in tech. They do sprints. So you kind of go into a room with the technologists for a few days with the performers, and you emerge the other side with the next phase of what you're doing. So when we go back into rehearsals, in a couple of weeks' time, we will have all of that totally locked down, and it's kind of bonkers, but it's great fun.
And will it be performed then, Roger, in a theatre space? Is it you're nodding a big no.
No, definitely. I mean, I don't really particularly, don't tell anyone, like theatre spaces. I find them probably the most dull places to make live performance. But no, it's being performed in a site-specific space in Kilkenny at the bottom of the parade. And then we're actually taking it to Nemo Biennale of Digital Arts in Paris in October. So it feels like, because, you know, it's not stuck to story, it's quite a non-narrative piece, it has that ability to tour. So I'm excited about what its future can be.
And this idea of the other, I mean, we who live under heaven, obviously there's the idea of the alien out there, but the other and alien in contemporary Europe, in the contemporary world, it has a whole other set of meanings. Was that in your mind in any way, Roger?
It's really, I guess I've been interested in I suppose what would you call it, the other, for many years in my composing. You know, I mentioned that I worked a lot with Alwyn Fueri. Mm. She says that I'm in communication with the mothership when we rehearse together, and anytime there's a pause and I scratch my head, she's always highly amused. Uh-oh, Roger's in touch with the mothership. Don't interrupt them.
Yeah. Have you experienced the mothership communication while watching Roger Joe?
We've gotten quite close, but I do think that the other, I think maybe that broader interpretation of what it is certainly something that is close to my heart. Like, I just feel we're in such a strange place in the world right now, and we other all the time. We, you know, things have become so individualized, and people's focus is so much on themselves that I believe and I hope that this piece will allow people to look outside themselves.
Well, I mean, the three of us are others from each other sitting in this studio, but that doesn't mean we have to hate each other.
No, not yet. We have another couple of minutes yet until the news comes
on. I know, you're okay. We've only a minute and 10 seconds. So here we are, five decades on, Roger. No sign of any of this stopping. And now that you've got lots of new technologies at your fingertips, the mothership has been contacted regularly, I'm guessing.
It has, yeah. I don't personally feel as though I am an alien. But I have huge interest in science fiction movies, science fiction books. And I also somehow feel as though it's tied in. You know, I spent 10 years on a project called Babel, and I got totally immersed in ancient civilizations, in ancient Babylon. And even there, there's lots of talk about, did the aliens...
Yeah, aliens and others.
Who built what? You know, who built the pyramids? So, you know, it somehow all ties in. My initial idea in talking to Joe was, let's have an alien on an Irish theatrical experience. We've seen aliens in movies. We've never seen one on a stage, you know.
Well, now we will.
Now we will.
And see and hear.
Our version of the holodeck, that's what I'm calling it.
Okay. Joe Mangan and Roger Doyle, thank you so much for coming in to me this evening. We Who Live Under Heaven is the show that Joe and Roger have been speaking to me about. It's at the Kilkenny Arts Festival, Sunday the 17th of August at the Watergate Theatre. And if you're lucky enough, is that right?
No, but that's fine. It's the 14th, the 17th, it's somewhere other than the Watergate. But Kilkenny Arts Festival is all the details.
Yeah, 14th to the 17th. Yes, because you said to me it was a site specific place, so how could it be there? So it's in some other place.
Some other secret place.
Yeah, there's another other. That's our lot for this Tuesday evening. Kieran Dunn was on sound this evening. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Research was by Leah Murphy. And tonight's programme was produced by Sheila O'Callaghan. Back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock here on RTÉ Radio 1. And John Creedon will be with you after the news.